Well, say that the tabletop is the old world, Warren explained. The area from which Jagang draws his troops. Now, there are places, to be sure, where there are few people spread over vast areas, but there are many places with great populations, too.
It's much the same in the New World, the general said. Dahara has populous places and desolate areas.
Warren shook his head. He passed his hand over the tabletop. Say this is the old world, the whole of this table.
He held up the rock to show the general, and then placed it on the edge of the tabletop.
This is the new world. This is its size, this rock, compared to the old world.
But that doesn't include Dahara, General Rybish sputtered. Surely, with Dahara...
Dahara is included in the rock. I'm afraid Warren is right, Verna said.
Sister Philippa, too, nodded her grim acknowledgement.
Perhaps, she said, looking down at her hands folded in her lap, perhaps Warren is right, and Richard has seen a vision of our defeat, and knows he must remain out of it, or be lost with all the rest of us.
I don't think that's it at all,
Zed offered in a gentle voice.
I know Richard. If Richard thought we would lose, he would say so in order to give people a chance to weigh that in their decisions.
The general cleared his throat. Well, actually one of the letters is missing from that stack. It was the first, where Lord Rao told me about his vision. In it, Lord Rao did say that we had no chance to win.
Zed felt the blood drain down into his legs. He tried to keep his manner unconcerned.
Oh? Where is the letter?
The general gave Verna a sidelong glance.
Well, actually, Verna said, when I read it, I was angered and...
And she balled it up and threw it in the fire, Warren finished for her.
Verna's face turned red, but she offered no defense. Zed could understand the sentiment, but he would have liked to have read it with his own eyes. He forced a smile.
Were those his actual words? That we had no chance to win?
Zed asked, trying not to sound alarmed.
He could feel sweat running down the back of his neck.
No,
General Rybish said as he shifted his shoulders inside his uniform while giving the question careful thought.
No, Lord Rao's words were that we must not commit our forces to an attack directly against the army of the Imperial Order, or our side will be destroyed and any chance for winning in the future will be forever lost.
The feeling began to return to Zed's fingers. He wiped a bead of sweat from the side of his forehead. He was able to draw an easier breath.
Well, that only makes sense. If they are as large a force as Warren says, then any direct attack would be foolhardy.
It did make sense. Zed wondered, though, why Richard would make such a point of it to a man of General Rybish's experience.
Perhaps Richard was only being cautious. There was nothing wrong with being cautious.
Addie slipped her hand under Zed's and cuddled her loose fist under his palm.
If you believe you must let Richard be in this, then you will stay? Help teach the gifted here what they must know?
Every face was etched with concern as they watched him, hanging on what he might decide. The general idly stroked a finger down the white scar on the side of his face. Sister Philippa knitted her fingers together. Verna and Warren entwined theirs. Zed smiled and hugged Addie's shoulders.
Of course I'm not going to abandon you.
The three on the bench opposite him each let out a little sigh. Their posture relaxed as if ropes around their necks had been slackened. Zed passed a hard look among them all.
War is nasty business. It's about killing people before they can kill you. Magic in war is simply another weapon, if a frightening one. You must realize that it too in this must be used for the end result of killing people.
What do we need to do?
Verna asked, clearly relieved that he had agreed to stay, but not to the obvious extent of General Rybish, Warren or Sister Philippa. Zed pulled some of his robes from each side of his legs over into the middle between them, as he gave the question some thought. It was not the sort of lesson he relished.
"Tomorrow morning we will begin. There is much to learn about countering magic in warfare. I will teach all the gifted some things about the awful business of using what you always hoped to use for good for harm instead. The lessons are not pleasing to endure, but then neither is the alternative."
The thought of such lessons, and worse, the use of such knowledge, could not be pleasant for any of them to contemplate. Addie, who knew a little bit about the horrific nature of such struggle, rubbed his back in sympathy. His heavy robes stuck to his skin. He wished he had his simple wizard's robes back.
"We will all do as we must to prevent our own people from falling to the monstrous magic of the Imperial Order," Verna said. "You have my word as prelate."
Zed nodded.
"Tomorrow, then, we begin."
"I fear to think of magic added to warfare," General Ryby said as he stood. Zed shrugged.
"To tell the truth, the ultimate object of magic in warfare is to counter the enemy's magic. If we do our job properly, we will bring balance to this. That would mean that all magic would be nullified, and the soldiers would then be able to fight without magic swaying the battle. You will be able to be the steel against steel, while we are the magic against magic."
"You mean your magic won't be of direct help to us?"
Zed shrugged.
"We will try to use magic to visit harm on them in any way we can. But when we try to use magic as a weapon, the enemy will try to counter ours. Any attempt to use their power against us, we will try to counter. The result of magic in warfare, if properly and expertly done, is that it seems as if magic did not exist at all. If we fail to rise to the challenge, then the power they throw at us will be truly horrific to witness. If we can best them, then you will see such destruction of their forces as you can't imagine. But, in my experience, magic has a way of balancing so that you rarely see such events."
"A deadlock, then, is our goal?" Sister Philippa asked.
Zed turned his palms up, moving his hands up and down in opposition as if they were scales holding great weight.
"The gifted on both sides will be working harder than they have ever worked before. I can tell you that it's exhausting. The result, except with small shifts in the advantage, is that it will seem as if we are all doing nothing to earn our dinner."
Zed let his hands drop.
"It will be punctuated with brief moments of sheer horror and true panic, when it seems beyond doubt that the world itself is about to end in one final fit of sheer madness."
General Rybish grinned in an odd, gentle, knowing way.
"Let me tell you, war, when you're holding a sword, looks about the same way."
He held up a hand in mock defense. "But I'd rather that, I guess, than have to swing my sword at every magic mosquito that came along. I'm a man of steel against steel. We have Lord Rahl to be the magic against the magic. I'm relieved we have Lord Rahl's grandfather, the first wizard, to aid us, too. Thank you, Zed. Anything you need is yours. Just ask."
Verna and Warren added silent nods as the general stepped to the entrance of the tent. When Zed spoke, General Rybish turned back, gripping the flap in one hand.
"You're still sending messengers to Richard?"
The general confirmed that they were. "Captain Myford was up there, too. He might be able to tell you more about Lord Rahl."
"Have all of the messengers returned safely?"
"Most of them." He rubbed his bearded chin. "We've lost two so far. One messenger was found by chance at the bottom of a rock slide. Another never returned, but his body wasn't found, which wouldn't be unusual. It's a long and difficult journey. There are any number of hazards on such a journey.
We have to expect we might lose a few men.
I'd like you to stop sending men up there to Richard.
But Lord Rao needs to be kept informed.
What if the enemy should capture one of those messengers and find out where Richard is? If you have no scruples, most any man can eventually be made to talk. The risk is not worth it.
The general rubbed his palm on the hilt of his sword as he considered Zed's words.
The order is far to the south of us, way down at Andereth. We control all the land between here and the mountains where Lord Rall is staying. He shook his head in resignation at Zed's unflinching gaze.
But if you think it's a concern, I'll not send another.
Won't Lord Rall wonder, though, what's going on with us?
What's going on with us is not really relevant to him right now. He is doing as he must do, and he can't allow our situation to influence him. He has told you already that he won't be able to give you any orders, that he must stay out of it.
Zed tugged his sleeve straight and sighed as he thought about it.
Perhaps when the summer is over, before the full grip of winter descends and they're snowed in way up there, I'll go and see how they fare.
General Rybish gave a departing smile.
If you could talk to Lord Rao, it would be a relief for us all, Zed. He would trust your word. Good night, then.
The man had just betrayed his true feelings. No one in the tent really trusted what Richard was doing, except perhaps Zed, and Zed had his doubts, too. Kaelin had said that she believed Richard viewed himself as a fallen leader. These people who claimed not to understand how he could believe such a thing, at the same time, didn't trust his actions. Richard was all alone with only the strength of his beliefs to support him. After the general had gone, Warren leaned forward eagerly.
Zed, I could go with you to see Richard. We could get him to tell us everything, and we could then determine if it's really a prophecy, or, as he says, just an understanding he's come to. If it's not really a prophecy, we might be able to make him see things differently. More importantly, we could begin teaching him, or you could anyway, about his gift, about using magic. He needs to know how to use his ability.
As Zed paced, Verna let out a little grunt to express her misgivings about Warren's suggestion.
I tried to teach Richard to touch his hand. A number of sisters attempted it too, but no one was able to make any progress.
But Zed believes a wizard is the one to do it. Isn't that right, Zed?
Zed halted his pacing and regarded them both a moment as he considered how to put his thoughts into words.
Well, as I said before, teaching a wizard is not really the work for sorceresses, but another wizard.
With Richard, I don't think you would have any better luck than we did,
Verna railed. Warren didn't give ground.
But Zed believes...
Zed cleared his throat, bidding silence.
You're right, my boy. It is the job of a wizard to teach another wizard born with the gift.
Verna lifted an angry finger to object, but Zed went right on.
In this case, however, I believe Verna is right.
She is? Warren asked. I am?
Verna asked. Zed waved in a mollifying gesture.
Yes, I believe so, Verna. I think the sisters can do some teaching. After all, look at Warren here. The sisters have managed to teach him something about using his gift, even if it was at the cost of time. You've taught others, if in a limited way, to my view of it. But you couldn't manage to teach Richard the most simple of things. Is that correct?
Verna's mouth twisted with displeasure.
None of us could teach him the simple task of sensing his own hand. I sat with him hours at a time and tried to guide him through it.
She folded her arms and looked away from his intent gaze.
It just didn't work the way it should have.
Warren touched a finger to his chin while he frowned, as if recalling something.
You know, Nathan said something to me once. I told him that I wanted to learn from him, that I wanted him to teach me about being a prophet. Nathan said that a prophet could not be made, but that they were born. I realized then that everything I knew and understood about prophecy, really understood about it in a whole new way, I had learned on my own, and not from anyone else. Could this, with Richard, be something like that? Is that your point, Zed?
It is.
Zed sat down once more on the hard wooden bench beside Addie.
I would love, not only as his grandfather, but as first wizard, to teach Richard what he needs to know about using his ability. But I'm coming to doubt that such a thing is possible. Richard is different from any other wizard in more ways than just having the gift for subtractive magic, in addition to the usual additive.
But still, Sister Philippa said, you are first wizard. Surely you would be able to teach him a great deal.
Zed pulled a fold of his heavy robes from between his bony bottom and the hard bench as he considered how to explain it.
Richard has done things even I don't understand. Without my training, he has accomplished more than I can even fathom. On his own, Richard reached the Temple of the Winds in the Underworld, accomplished the task of stopping a plague, and returned from beyond the veil to the world of life. Can any of you even grasp such a thing? Especially for an untrained wizard. He banished the chimes from the world of the living. How? I have no idea. He has worked magic I've never heard of, much less seen or understand. I'm afraid my knowledge could be more of an interference than an aid. Part of Richard's ability and advantage is the way he views the world. Through not just fresh eyes, but the eyes of a seeker of truth. He doesn't know something is impossible, so he tries to accomplish it. I fear to tell him how to do things, how to use his magic, because such teaching also might suggest to him limits of his powers, thus creating them in reality. What could I teach a war wizard? I know nothing about the subtractive side of magic, much less the gift of such power.
Lacking another war wizard with subtractive magic, are you suggesting it would maybe take a Sister of the Dark to teach him?
Warren asked.
Well, Zed mused, that might be a thought.
He let out a tired sigh as he turned more serious.
I have come to realize that it would not only be useless to try to teach Richard to use his ability, but it may even be dangerous to the world. I would like to go see him and offer him my encouragement, experience, and understanding, but help?
Zed shook his head.
I don't dare.
No one offered any objection. Verna, for one, had first-hand experience that very likely confirmed the truth of his words. The rest of them probably knew Richard well enough to understand much the same.
May I help you find a spare tent, Zed? Verna finally asked. You look like you could use some rest. In the morning, after you get a good night's rest, and we all think this over, we can talk more.
Warren, who had just been about to ask another question before Verna spoke first, looked disappointed but nodded in agreement. Zed stretched his legs out straight as he yawned.
That would be best.
The thought of the job ahead was daunting. He ached to see Richard, to help him, especially after searching for him for so long. Sometimes it was hard to leave people alone when that was what they most needed.
That would be best,
he repeated.
I am tired.
Summer be slipping away from us. The nights be turning chilly,
Addie said as she pressed against Zed's side. She looked up at him with her white eyes that in the lamplight had a soft amber cast.
Stay with me and warm my bones, old man.
Zed smiled as he embraced her. It was as much of a comfort to be with her again as he had expected. In fact, at that moment, if she had given him another hat with a feather, he would have donned it, and with a smile. Worry, though, ached through his bones like an approaching storm. "Zed," Verna said, seeming to notice in his eyes the weight of his thoughts, "Richard is a war wizard who, as you say, has in the past proven his remarkable ability. He's a very resourceful young man. Besides that, he is none other than the Seeker himself, and has the Sword of Truth with him for protection. A sword I can testify he knows how to use. Kaelin is a confessor, the Mother Confessor, and is experienced in the use of her power. They have a Mord Sith with them. Mord Sith take no chances."
"I know," Zed whispered, staring off into a nightmare swirl of thoughts. "But I still fear greatly for them."
"What is it that worries you so?" Warren asked.
"Albino mosquitoes."
Chapter 18. Panting in exhaustion, Kaelin had to dance backward through the snarl of hobblebush, stitched through with thorny blackberry, to dodge the swing of the sword. The tip whistled past, missing her ribs by an inch. In her mad dash to escape, she ignored the snag and tug of thorns on her pants. She could feel her heartbeat galloping at the base of her skull. As he relentlessly pressed his attack, forcing her back over a low rise of ledge and through the swale beyond, mounds of fallen leaves kicked aloft by his boots boiled up into the late afternoon air like colorful thunderheads. The bright yellow, lustrous orange, and vivid red leaves rained down over rocky outcrops swaddled in prickly whorls of juniper. It was like doing battle amid a fallen rainbow. Richard lunged at her again. Kaelin gasped, but blocked his sword. He pressed his grim attack with implacable determination. She gave ground, stepping high as she did so in order to avoid tripping over the snare of roots around a huge white spruce. Losing her footing would be fatal. If she fell, Richard would stab her in an instant. She glanced left. There loomed a tall prominence of sheer rock draped with long trailers of woolly moss. To the other side, the brink of the ridge ran back to eventually meet that rock wall. Once the level ground tapered down to that dead end, the only option was going to be a climb straight up or straight down. She deflected a quick thrust of his sword and he warded hers. In a burst of fury, she pressed a fierce assault, forcing him back a dozen steps. He effortlessly parried her strikes, and then returned her attack in kind. What she had gained was quickly lost twice over. She was once again desperately defending herself and trading ground for her life. On a low dead branch of a balsam fir not 10 feet away, a small red squirrel with his winter ear tufts already grown in, plucked a leathery brown rosette of lichen growing on the bark. With his white belly gloriously displayed, he sat on his haunches at the end of the broken-off deadwood, his bushy tail raised up, holding the crinkled piece of lichen in his tiny paws, eating round and round the edges like some spectator at a tournament eating a fried bread cake while he watched the combatants clash. Kaelin gulped air as her eyes darted around, looking for clear footing among the imposing trunks of the highland wood, while at the same time watching for an opportunity that might save her. If she could somehow get around Richard, around the menace of his sword, she might be able to gain a clear escape route. He would run her down, but it would buy her time. She dodged a quick thrust of his sword and ducked around a maple sapling into a bed of brown and yellow bracken ferns dappled by glowing sunlight. Richard, driving forward in a sudden mad rush to end it, lifted his sword to hack her. It was her opening, her only chance. In a blink, Kaelin reversed her retreat and sprang ahead a step, ducking under his arm. She drove her sword straight into his soft middle. Richard covered the wound with both hands. He teetered a moment and then crumpled into the bed of ferns, sprawling flat on his back. Leaves lying lightly atop taller ferns were lifted by the disturbance. They somersaulted up into the air, finally drifting down to brightly decorate his body. The fierce red of the maple leaves was so vibrant it would have made blood look brown by comparison. Kaelin stood over Richard, gasping to catch her breath. She was spent. She dropped to her knees, then threw herself across his supine body.
All around them, fern fronds, the color of caramel candy, were curled into little fists, as if in defiance of having to die with the season. The sprinkling of lighter, yellowish, hay-scented ferns lent a clean, sweet scent to the afternoon air. There were few things that could equal the fragrance of the woods in late autumn. In a spectacular bit of chance, a tall maple nearby, sheltered as it was by a protective corner in the rock wall, was not yet denuded, but displayed a wide spread of leaves so orange they looked tangy against the powder-blue sky above.
Kara!
Putting her left hand to Rich's chest, Kaylin pushed herself up on one arm to call out,
Kara! I killed Richard!
Kara, not far off, laying on her belly at the edge of the ridge as she watched out beyond, said nothing.
I killed him! Did you hear, Kara? Did you see?
Yes, she muttered.
I heard. You killed Lord Rahl.
No, you didn't, Richard said, still catching his breath. She whacked him across the shoulder with her willow-switch sword.
Yes, I did. I killed you this time. Killed you dead.
You only grazed me. He pressed the point of his willow-switch to her side.
You've fallen into my trap. I have you at the point of my sword. Now, surrender or die, woman. Never, she said. Still gasping for breath as she laughed. I'd rather die than be captured by the likes of you, you rogue!
She stabbed him repeatedly in his ribs with her willow practice sword as he giggled and rolled from side to side.
Kara, did you see? I killed him this time. I finally got him.
Yes, all right, Kara grouched as she intently watched out beyond the ridge.
You killed Lord Rahl. Good for you.
She glanced back over her shoulder.
This one is mine, right, Lord Rahl? You promised this one was mine.
Yes, Richard said, still catching his breath. This one goes for yours, Kara.
Good,
Kara smiled in satisfaction.
It's a big one.
Richard smirked up at Kaylin. I let you kill me, you know.
No, you didn't. I won. I got you this time.
She whacked him again with her willow sword. She paused and frowned.
I thought you said you weren't dead. You said it was only a scratch. Ha! You admitted I got you this time,
Richard chuckled.
I let you.
Kaylin kissed him to shut him up. Kara saw and rolled her eyes. When Kara looked back over the ridge, she suddenly sprang up.
They just left. Come on, before something gets it.
Kara, nothing is going to get it, Richard said.
Not this quickly. Come on! You promised this one was mine. I don't want to have gone through all this for nothing. Come on!
All right, all right, Richard said as Kaylin climbed off him.
We're coming.
He held his hand out for Kaylin to help him up. She stabbed him in the ribs instead.
Got you again, Lord Rahl. You're getting sloppy.
Richard only smiled as Kaylin finally offered her hand. When he was up, he hugged her in a quick gesture, and before turning to follow after Kara, said,
Good job, Mother Confessor.
Good job. You killed me dead. I'm proud of you. Kaylin endeavored to show him a sedate smile, but she feared it came out as a giddy grin. Richard scooped up his pack and hefted it onto his back. Without delay, he started the descent down the steep, broken face of the mountain. Kaylin threw her long wolf's fur mantle around her shoulders and followed him through the deep shade of sheltering spruce at the edge of the ridge, stepping on the exposed ledge rather than the low places.
Be careful, Richard called out to Kara, already a good distance ahead of them. With all the leaves covering the ground, you can't see holes or gaps in the rock. I know, she grumbled. How many times do you think I need to hear it?
Richard constantly watched out for them both. He had taught them how to walk in such terrain, and what to be careful of. From the beginning, marching through the forests and mountains, Kaylin noted that Richard moved with quiet fluidity, while Kara traipsed along, bounding up onto and off of rocks and ledges, almost like an exuberant youngster. Since Kara had spent most of her life indoors, she didn't know that it made a difference how you walked in such terrain. Richard had patiently explained to her,
"Pick where to put your feet in order to make your steps comparatively level. Don't step down to a lower spot if you don't need to, only to have to step up again as you continue your climb up the trail.
Don't step up needlessly, only to have to step down again. If you must step up on something, you don't always need to lift your whole body. Just flex your legs.
Kara complained that it was too hard to think about where to put her foot each time. He told her that by walking the way she did, she was actually climbing the mountain twice for each time he climbed it. He admonished her to think as she walked, and soon it would become instinctive and would require no conscious thought. When Kara found that her shin and thigh muscles didn't get as tired and sore when she followed his suggestions, she became a keen student. Now she asked questions instead of arguing, most of the time. Kaylin saw that as Kara descended the steep trail, she did as Richard had taught her and used a stick as an improvised staff to probe any suspicious low area where leaves collected before stepping there. This was no place to break an ankle. Richard said nothing, but sometimes he smiled when she found a hole with her stick rather than her foot, as she used to. Forging a new trail on a steep slope like the one they were descending was dangerous work. Potential trails often withered into dead ends, requiring that you retrace your steps. On less severe slopes, hillsides, and flatter ground especially, animals often made good trails. In a valley, a suitable trail that shrank to nothing wasn't a big problem, because there you could beat through the brush to more open ground. Making your own trail on a rocky precipice 1,000 feet up was always arduous and often frustrating. In such conditions, particularly if the hour grew late, the desire not to have to backtrack a difficult climb tempted people into taking chances. Richard said that it was hard work that demanded you put reason before your wish to get down, get home, or get to a place to camp. "Wishing gets people killed," he often said. "Using your head gets you home." Kara poked her stick into a pile of leaves between bare granite rocks. "Don't step in the leaves here," she said over her shoulder as she hopped onto the far rock. "There's a hole." "Why, thank you, Kara," Richard said in mock gratitude, as if he would have stepped there had she not warned him. The cliff face they were on had a number of sizable ledges with rugged little trees and shrubs that provided good footing and the safety of a handhold. Below, the mountainside dropped away before them into a lush ravine. Beyond the defile, it rose up again in a steep slope covered with evergreens and the dull gray and brown skeletons of oaks, maples, and birches. The raucous coats of autumn leaves had been resplendent while they lasted, but now they were but confetti on the ground, and there they faded fast. Usually the oaks held onto their leaves until at least early winter, and some of them until spring. But up in the mountains, icy winds and early storms had already stripped even the oaks bare of their tenacious brown leaves. Kara stepped out onto a shelf of ledge jutting out over the chasm below. "There," she said, as she pointed across the way. "Up there, do you see?" Richard shielded his eyes against the warm sunlight as he squinted higher up on the opposite slope. He made a sound deep in his throat to confirm that he saw it. "Nasty place to die." Kaylin snugged the warm wolf fur up against her ears to protect them from the cold wind. "There's a good place?" Richard let his hand drop from his brow. "I guess not." Farther up the slope from where Kara had pointed, the forest ended in a place called the Crooked Wood. Above that, where no trees could grow, the mountain was naked rock ridges and scree. A little farther up, snow, white as sugar, sparkled in the slanting sunlight. Below the snow and bare rock, the Crooked Wood was exposed to harsh winds and bitter weather, causing the trees to grow in tortured shapes. The Crooked Wood was a line of demarcation between the desolation where little more than lichen could survive the forbidding weather, and the forest of trees huddled below. Richard gestured off to their right. "Let's not waste any time, though. I don't want to be caught up here come dark." Kaylin looked out to where the mountain opened onto a grand vista of snow-capped peaks, valleys, and the undulating green of seemingly endless, trackless forests. A roiling blanket of thick clouds had invaded those valleys, stealing in around the mountains, sneaking ever closer. In the distance, some of the snow-capped peaks stood isolated in a cottony gray sea.
Lower down the mountains, below those dense, dark clouds, the weather would be miserable. Both Richard and Kara awaited Kaelin's word. She didn't like the thought of being exposed in the Crooked Wood when the icy cold fog and drizzle arrived.
"I'm fine. Let's go and get it done. Then we can get down lower where we'll be able to find a wayward pine to stay dry tonight. I wouldn't mind sitting beside a hearty little fire sipping hot tea."
Kara blew warm breath into her cupped hands.
"That sounds good to me."
It was on the first day Kaelin met Richard, more than a year before, that he had taken her to a wayward pine. Kaelin had never known about such trees in the deep woods of Westland. Wayward pines still held the same mystic quality for her as they did the first time she saw one silhouetted against a darkening sky, taller than all the trees around it. Such mature trees were a friend to travelers far from any conventional shelter. A big wayward pine's boughs hung down to the ground all around. The needles grew mostly at the outer fringe, leaving the inner branches bare. Inside, under their dense green skirts, wayward pines provided excellent shelter from harsh weather. Something about the tree's sap made them resistant to fire, so if you were careful, you could have a cozy campfire inside while outside it rained and stormed. Richard, Kaelin, and Kara often stayed in wayward pines when they were out in the mountains. Those nights getting warm around a small fire within the tree's confines brought them all closer and gave them time to reflect, to talk, and to tell stories. Some of the stories made them laugh. Some brought a lump to their throats. After Kaelin's assurance that she was up to it, Richard and Kara nodded and started down the cliff. She had recovered from her terrible wounds, but they still left it up to her to decide if she was prepared for the effort of such a descent and climb, and then descent again before they found a sheltered campsite, hopefully in a wayward pine. Kaelin had been a long time in healing. She had known, of course, that injuries such as she had suffered would take time to heal. Bedridden for so long, her muscles had become withered, weak, and nearly useless. For a long time, it had been hard for her to eat much. She became a skeleton. With the realization of just how weak and helpless she had become, even as she healed, she had inexorably spiraled down into a state of abject depression. Kaelin had not comprehended completely the punishing effort that would be required if she was to be herself again. Richard and Kara tried to cheer her up, but their efforts seemed distant. They just didn't understand what it was like. Her legs wasted away until they were bony sticks with knobby knees. She felt not just helpless, but ugly. Richard carved animals for her. Hawks, foxes, otters, ducks, and even chipmunks. They seemed only a curiosity to her. At the lowest point, Kaelin almost wished she had died along with her child. Her life became a tasteless gruel. All she saw, day after day, week after week, were the four walls of her sick room. The pain was exhausting and the monotony numbing. She came to hate the bitter yarrow tea they made her drink, and the smell of the poultice made of tall cinquefoil and yarrow. When, after a time, she resisted drinking yarrow, they would sometimes switch to linden, which wasn't so bitter, but didn't work as well. Yet it did help her sleep. Skullcap often helped when her head hurt, though it was so astringent it made her mouth pucker for a long time after. Sometimes they switched to a tincture of feverfew to help ease her pain. Kaelin came to hate taking herbs, and would often say she didn't hurt when she did, just to avoid some horrid concoction. Richard hadn't made the window in the bedroom very big. In the summer heat, the room was often sweltering. Kaelin could see only a bit of the sky outside her window, the tops of some trees, and the jagged blue-gray shape of a mountain in the distance. Richard wanted to take her outside, but Kaelin begged him not to try, because she didn't think it would be worth the pain. It didn't take much convincing for him to be talked out of hurting her. Every kind of day, from sunny and bright to gray and gloomy, came and went. Lying in her little room as time slipped away, while she slowly healed, Kaelin thought of it as her lost summer. One day she was parched, and Richard had forgotten to fill the cup and place it where she could reach it on the simple table beside the bed. When she asked for water,
Richard came back with a cup and a full water skin and set them both on the windowsill as he called to Kara outside. He rushed out, telling Kalin as he went that he and Kara had to go check the fishing lines and they would be back as soon as they could. Before Kalin could ask him to put the water closer, he was gone. Kalin lay fuming in the silence, hardly able to believe that Richard had been so inconsiderate as to leave the water out of her reach. It was unusually warm for late summer. Her tongue felt swollen. She stared helplessly at the wooden cup setting on the windowsill. On the verge of tears, she let out a moan of self-pity and smacked her fist against the bed. She rolled her head to the right, away from the window, and closed her eyes. She decided to take a nap in order to not think about her thirst. Richard and Kara would be back by the time she awoke, and they would get the water for her, and Richard would get a scolding. Sweat trickled down her neck. Outside, a bird kept calling. Its repetitious song sounded like a little girl with a high-pitched voice saying, "Who me?" Once a "Who me?" bird started in. It was a long performance. Kalin could think of little else other than how much she wanted a drink. She couldn't make herself fall asleep. The annoying bird kept asking its question over and over again. More than once she found herself whispering, "Yes, you," in answer. She growled a curse at Richard. She squeezed her eyes shut and tried to forget her thirst, the heat, and the bird, and go to sleep. Her eyes kept popping open. Kalin lifted her sleeping gown away from her chest, ruffling it up and down to cool herself. She realized she was staring at the water in the window. It was out of her reach. Clear over on the other side of the room. The room wasn't very big, but still, she couldn't walk. Richard knew better. She thought that maybe, if she could sit up and move to the bottom of the bed, she might be able to reach the cup. With an ill-tempered huff, she threw the light cover off her bony legs. She hated seeing them. Why was Richard being so inconsiderate? What was the matter with him? She intended to give him a piece of her mind when he got back. She eased her legs over the side of the bed. The mattress was a pliable woven mat stuffed with grasses and feathers and tow padding. It was quite comfortable, and Kalin was pleased with his snug bed. With a great effort, she pushed herself up. For a long time, she sat on the edge of the bed, holding her head in her hands as she caught her breath. Her whole body throbbed in pain. It was the first time she had sat up all by herself. She understood very well what Richard was doing. Still, she didn't appreciate his way of forcing her to get up. It was cruel. She wasn't ready. She was still badly hurt. She needed to rest in bed in order to recover. Her oozing wounds had finally closed up and healed over, but she was sure she was still too injured to be getting up. She feared to test broken bones. Accompanied by a lot of groaning and grunting, she worked herself to the bottom of the bed. Sitting there, one hand holding the footboard to steady herself, she was still too far from the window to reach the water. She was going to have to stand. She paused for a while to have dark thoughts about her husband. After a day many weeks before, when she had called for a long time and Richard hadn't heard her weak voice, he had left a light pole beside her so she would be able to use it to reach out and knock on the wall or door if she was in urgent need of their help. Now Kalin worked her fingers around the pole lying alongside her bed and lifted it upright. She planted the thicker end on the ground and leaned on the pole for support as she carefully slid off the bed. Her feet touched the cool dirt floor. Putting weight on her legs made her gasp in pain. She half stood, half leaned on the bed, prepared to cry out, but realized she was gasping more at the brutal pain she expected than from the actual pain. It did hurt, but she realized it wasn't too much to endure. She was a bit disgruntled to learn it wasn't nearly as bad as it had been. She had been planning on reducing Richard to tears with the torturous suffering he had so cavalierly forced upon her. She put more weight on her feet and pulled herself up with the aid of the pole. Finally, she stood in wobbling triumph. She was actually on her feet, and she had done it by herself. Kaylin couldn't seem to make her legs walk the way she wanted them to. In order to get to the water, she was going to have to make them do her bidding, at least until she reached the window. Then she could collapse to the floor, where Richard would find her. She luxuriated in her mental picture of it. He wouldn't think his plan to get her out of bed so clever then. With the aid of the stout pole for support and her tongue poked out the corner of her mouth for balance, she slowly shuffled to the window. Kaylin told herself that if she fell, she was going to lie there in a heap on the floor without any water until Richard came back and found her moaning through cracked lips, dying of thirst. He would be sorry he had ever tried such a pitiless trick. He would feel guilty for the rest of his life for what he had done to her. She would see to it. Almost wishing every difficult step of the way that she would fall, she finally made it to the window. Kaylin threw an arm over the sill for support and closed her eyes as she panted in little breaths so as not to hurt her ribs. When she had her wind back, she drew herself up to the window. She snatched the cup and gulped down the water. Kaylin plunked the empty cup down on the sill and peered out as she caught her breath again. Richard was sitting on the ground just outside, his arms hooked around his knees, his hands clasped. "Hi there," he said with a smile. Kara, sitting right beside him, gazed up without emotion. "I see you're up." Kaylin wanted to yell at him, but instead she found herself trying with all her might not to laugh. She felt suddenly and overwhelmingly foolish for not trying sooner to get up on her own. Tears stung her eyes as she looked out at the expanse of trees, the vibrant colors, the majestic mountains, and the huge sweep of blue sky dotted with fluffy white clouds marching off into the distance.
This is the end of this cassette. This program is continued on side one of cassette number 6.